Well, hey everybody, it's Mike and Chris from rollercoasterrally.com. We're excited to be broadcasting this for you. This is kind of our first time trying out the broadcast through a podcast.
So what are we going to call our podcast? We got to come up with a cool name for it somehow.
I have no idea.
Oh, whatever.
We'll figure something out. We'll figure
Yeah.
something out.
Send us your ideas. We'll
Yeah, exactly.
take suggestions.
That's assuming that there's going to be more than one of these, of course. So anyways,
Hopefully.
yeah, everybody, we're excited to be doing this. We've got something special to share today. We've got a interview that we were fortunate enough to be able to conduct with the owner and founder of Silverwood, Mr. Gary Norton. We were at the park this summer, and I gotta say, Chris, I really didn't think that this interview was actually going to happen. In fact, when we first asked if it could take place, the folks at Silverwood said, "Well, we'd love to do it, but he's such a busy guy, and his schedule is so,
Yeah,
hectic."
he's very, very busy guy, understandably. When you're running a theme park, I guess it's not like you got a whole lot of spare time on your hands.
Exactly. And he said they told us, they flat out told us that it probably wouldn't happen. But then we got to the park, and next thing
They
we
snuck up on us.
know, and yeah, they said, "Hey, he's ready." And we did it. And I can't say that I was as prepared as I wanted to be, but it was awesome to be able to meet Gary and talk with him.
Well, how can you truly be prepared for something like that,
Well,
though?
yeah,
I
that's a good point. That's a very good point. So for those of you out there who are listening to this and wondering who the heck we are and what we're doing, let me give you a little bit of background. So I'm Mike, and my brother Chris, we have been theme park enthusiasts our whole life. Gosh, I don't know. I've been riding roller coasters since I was probably 7 years old. Chris, you were probably
Yeah, same here.
great.
I don't remember when I went on my first one. It's
I gotta
been
say,
so long.
I think you were probably younger than me because I was a chicken until I hit about 7 or 8 years old of roller coasters, and then I just all of a sudden became an addict. And I think when I became an addict, I started forcing you.
Yeah, I was gonna say I never had the opportunity to be a chicken on those rides. You
No.
just put me on them and said, go.
Yeah, I remember that a few times. And anyways, that's the luxury of being the older brother, I guess. So, anyways, we about what was it, about 2001, 12 years ago.
Yes. Yep,
Gosh,
2001.
we started a website for our home park, Silverwood, which at the time was just a small theme park. It did have a couple of wooden coasters. They were both relatively new. It was very unknown. I don't think it was much on the map at that point. Of course, Tremors helped, but
Yes, absolutely.
we started the website, and gosh, if I remember right, it was pretty pathetic looking for years. I'm not gonna say.
I try to forget those days,
Yeah,
but it's come a long way since, definitely.
we've come a long way. I mean, we're not cutting edge per se, but we've definitely made improvements. If anyone's interested, I think you've still got some screenshots of the original website, and that's
It's ugly.
I think my 3-year-old could probably do better with a crayon, so I don't know. That's not to say anything against you or I. We just this is that was all new to us back then. But we grew the website as Silverwood grew. We were fortunate enough to be able to make contacts with folks at the park, employees, management. And they've been just so awesome in giving us a heads up when new things are coming down the pipeline, and helping us arrange interviews like the one that we're going to share with you today. And we've really we've developed a great relationship with them. And Chris and I have expanded the website. We've got message boards. We've got a wiki on there. We've got a
You have a
store.
podcast
And now we're trying to do a podcast.
now.
We'll see how this goes. And I gotta warn you folks out there that look, we know that there are other theme park enthusiasts who do podcasts on a regular basis, and we know that in comparison to them, this is not going to be that great. We're beginners, and so bear with us. We're just doing this for the first time, and we're going to see how it goes. So Hey, look, before we get into this though, let's talk a little bit about Gary. I mean, Gary Norton, founder, owner of Silverwood. Now he's written a book. Chris, you know more about this than I do. Talk a little bit about it.
So Gary started the theme park officially in 1988, but the story in the book goes back way before then, from his days as a career or a computer programmer. He actually had his own computer programming company where he wrote a bunch of software for banks and beat out a bunch of the big companies with the products that he made. And that just kind of just gives you a little bit of a flavor for just how smart this guy truly is. I mean, if you can imagine, I mean, he's competing against like IBM and some of those other big names, and he was able to win, beat him out back then, and then took all that knowledge and all that success that he had and started to kind of just go have some fun with his
Yeah, he
life
started
from
living his
there.
dream, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he started to really get into. His two main hobbies were boating and aviation, and the aviation side is really what spawned this the Silverwood Park, because he bought the airstrip up in northern Idaho,
Right.
the Henley Aerodrome. And many of these people listening to this probably have no idea, but Silverwood is actually built right next to a runway, an airport runway,
Yep.
which is still there actually. So he bought that and used that to collect some very how do we say this, antique airplanes that he liked to fly.
There you go.
And then and one of the times he was down at an auction, he happened to see an old steam locomotive that someone was trying to sell, and he thought, well, I got to get my hands on that. That thing's really cool. And so he started to bid on it, and eventually got to the point where it was just coming down to him and one other person. And
This is the story that everybody hears. Yeah.
Then it just turns out that other person that was bidding on the train was from this small obscure company. You probably never heard of it. It's called Disney.
Yeah, exactly.
I
Who are they?
don't know, something like that. Anyway, so what ended up happening was Gary actually ended up winning the auction, simply because the guy at Disney actually only had so much money that he was allowed to spend. Once he hit that limit, he had to go call someone at Disney to try to get permission to spend more. By the time he'd come back, the auction was over and Gary had won. So now he's got this train, right? He takes it back up to Idaho with him and puts it all together, puts the track together on this big piece of property he's got up there. And well, as they say, the rest is history. It just sort of took off from there. He started out with just a town and a couple of rides, and
He just
then
he did,
got some more rides, and
yeah, and he did a great job. And I mean, it was so small. I remember the first time that I went to Silverwood. When I went there, the Thunder Canyon raft ride was brand new. I think I can remember how small the park was, but I remember thinking to myself that this is something special. And you could just kind of see this guy's fingerprints all over the place. I mean, he's fortunate enough to do what a lot of us theme park enthusiasts dream about, which is, start a theme park from scratch and do it exactly the way you want to. And I mean, fortunately, he hit it big in his career and had the money to be able to do, what he always dreamed about. And
And
if you
it's way more than just the money, though. I mean, the guy knows his stuff, and it shows in the theme park. I mean, anyone with a lot of money could try to build a theme park, but to do it right, you got to have the knowledge and the skills to be able to run an operation like that, and to do it the way that draws people and has them thinking, wow, like you said, this is really something unique and special, and it's not just a
Yeah.
bunch of rides thrown together on a concrete slab that you pay money to go see. It's really, a well done, cool theme park.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it doesn't get the notoriety that a lot of the big parks get, just because the collection of rides is relatively small. It still is. It's getting better and better. But I mean, other than the couple wooden coasters and maybe the Vekoma giant inverted boomerang, there's not really much there that people are going to make a trip for. And even those selections, a lot of people are going to look at those and say, well, I don't know if that's worth the trip. It's remote. It's really out in the middle of nowhere. It's in a section of the country that doesn't have a whole lot of theme parks to begin with. And so you understand why It's a smaller player, but it really is something special. I mean, you go to Silverwood and you see the quality of the place, and I mean, in my opinion, it's something unique. It's something that you normally only see at, say, the Disney or the Universal type parks. There's attention to detail that the majority of theme parks out there just don't, for whatever reason, give their parks. Silverwood does.
Yep.
It shows, and the rides show it as well. Not every ride, but a lot of the rides are built into the landscaping. They're built into the scenery, and you just don't get that everywhere. You get a lot of the, hey, to your point, let's just put a concrete slab in there and put the coaster down. Silverwood says, how do we build this around the terrain and make this thing look neat and interact with the scenery and the guests? And they've done that with most of especially their newer attractions, and it's great to see that. So anyways,
Totally.
let's not waste any more time here
Yeah,
talking. Let's get into the good stuff, because the interview with Gary is where you will really get an appreciation for this guy, what he has done, and just what a great guy he is. I mean, I just was very impressed with his character and personality. So without any further ado, here is our interview with Gary Norton.
okay. Well, this is Mike and Chris from Roller Coaster Alley, and we're here with Silverwood founder and owner and author Gary Norton. And Gary, we're really honored to be able to have a few minutes to talk to you today.
Well, I'm glad you could come up and have some good time here.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful day, and we're enjoying ourselves quite a bit. So one thing we noticed when we walked in, obviously today, this is our first time up this season, but the new entryway that the park's got, there's all these new buildings and plaza. And tell us a little bit about that. What kind of went into the decision-making process around making that bigger? And
Well, when we first built the entrance, obviously we were a lot smaller, had no idea where we were going, and it was extremely small for the park as it's grown, and it was a bottleneck. And then when we had the change in the highway with the new interchange and having to close down the parking lot on the west side, the close one, which was really excellent for us because now we could get that land back and use it for something else, I decided to just go all out and make an entrance that lasts another 25 to 30 years or something like that.
Yeah,
So.
no, that's great. It's definitely seems like it can handle the crowds, and of course it's a lot bigger, and so it just seems like it makes sense with how busy the park's been getting the past few years. I know we've seen some pretty incredible sized crowds, especially in the past few years. But so tell us a little bit about, I know, like, for some of our listeners who maybe haven't had a chance to read your book or go there yet, tell us just a little bit about kind of your background with Silverwood. I mean, what got you into this? What interested you in wanting to go down this path of a theme park?
Oh, probably just like a lot of people when you grow up seeing theme parks. In my case, it was Disneyland, seeing it
Okay.
as a kid on TV when I was in Florida growing up, visiting it when I was early 20s, and just enjoying the feeling that you got when you were there. And I had no idea you're going to build a theme park, but the difference was I didn't go there and just ride rides. I went there and I've got a different kind of outlook on things. I look at it from a business angle and why do you feel good when you're here? So I just took the details apart, even from my earliest visits. Why does it feel good? And I just sit in benches and look at people and look at the details and say, well, I'm getting it. I know what they're doing and why when you leave smoggy, miserable LA and you come through the gates, all of a sudden your life changes. And it's just something that always stayed with me. And I was lucky enough to been in the computer business since I was a young kid, since I was 18, and did really well in there and started a computer company and had some money to play around with, and still young enough, early 30s, that I started building something, and that's basically what happened in Idaho. And it just took off from actually initially it was a love of aviation. I had old antique airplanes and an old airstrip that I bought, and then I just started adding things to it, and an old steam train. And then I decided, well, we have to have a town to run that through, so we built the Victorian town,
Right.
and along the lines, a little bit of the Disney-ish 1800 style. And
Right.
but the one thing we did from the beginning was go super high quality. I mean, the buildings and everything were way beyond anything was being built. Even had Disney people come up and say, we don't build like this. We use faux painting, and you use you know, really carved the wood and put in the real antique pieces and things. So it was way overbuilt when we did it. You know, difficult to make a living at it in North Idaho, but it was definitely worth doing.
Right. Shut this thing off. But, sure. No problem.
Now it works out because it sets the stage for the rest of the park. You know, we've grown a little bit continuously forever. It seems like 25, 26 years constantly adding things.
Right.
But it goes back to the heritage of the quality of the beginning of the park. And the last few years I've been going back to that, concentrating on trying to see if we can't bring up the level of quality everywhere. If you've noticed, the gardens now is one of my big features. I've put a staff of horticulturists together to try and see if we can't make the best gardens anywhere. I mean, as much as we can with our weather climate. But that's an ongoing project. The new front entrance is another example of going back to our roots and trying to go over the top with the buildings and the details and, you know, the bricks out there, the all hand-laid bricks is an example. They brought in new bricks, wanted to lay them nice and straight, and I said, no, it doesn't look right. And we tumbled them three times. They knocked the corners off and beat them up and then had them lay them and just kind of in a patterns that were all wavy and wiggly. It looked like they'd been there forever. And the bricklayer saying, we don't do this. I say, yeah, but we do it here. So just humor me and do it that way. So that's the kind of thing we like to do.
Oh, that's great. I think, that, you know, to your point, I mean, that's a lot of that kind of thing stands the test of time. And then you can look back on it and say, yeah, we did it right the first time. And that's definitely important. So obviously, you know, one of the big things that I've seen change over the year was when Boulder Beach was built. I mean, that was such a major, I mean, you know, a lot of theme parks out there have water parks attached to them. And that's not really anything unusual, but up here, it seemed like that was a real turning point, at least for me, in the size of the park and kind of the recognition that it got. And maybe that's just my perspective, but it just seemed like you had a good collection of rides going, but then all of a sudden now it became something so much bigger. I know when Boulder Beach opened, I started feeling like I need more than one day here now. And what kind of went into the decision of, you know, Boulder Beach and making a water park?
Well, I was always looking for what's the next thing to do to grow the park. And as we grew the park, there was always trying to find what draws attention, what do people really like to do. And that's where after the corkscrew, we're trying to find something else. I came up with that Thunder Canyon. You know, I said, let's do a whitewater raft ride. And then it was the wooden coasters, and that had a nice impact. But after a while, you know, you're going after the same market, the same type of thing, and then we decided we've got to do something different. So that's when, looking at other parks with water parks, I thought we'd, you know, do the same thing and with our quality and try to build a water park that was really an upscale water park, not just some place you go dump your kids on a bunch of concrete and water. Lots of landscaping, lots of paths everywhere, and lots of features. And it definitely took off because we had about 35-40% increase that year with attendance, and the water park we built was too small on day one. We had no idea they were going to show up with those kind of numbers, so we had to double the size of the water park 2 years later. And it's done really well because as you said, it takes more than one day to really adequately do the park, and so it's 2 or 3 days now that people come over for vacations and spend in the park.
So as you guys go, you know, each year you kind of look at where you're at, and, you know, some years it's like there's a new slide at Boulder Beach, and then some years there's a new ride, like this year there's the spin cycle ride. And so how do you decide where you're going to focus or what you're going to give the attention to?
Sometimes it's just a matter of something that comes up, like the Aftershock was an example of Six Flags being, you know, bankrupt just about and needing to change their parks, and they just dumped those rides. And I got an offer just on a phone, hey, you want to have a giant inverted boomerang? I knew nothing about the ride, and at a really, really cheap price, you know, compared to what they were new, and I went, sure, let's go get it. After I bought it and found out how much trouble they had with that ride and how miserable that was and probably the most complex coaster ever built to try to run and operate, I thought, oh, what did I get myself into? But we had some really good guys. The guy that put it back up, Fred Grubb from Rocky Mountain Coasters, I'm sure you know about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He is absolutely phenomenal. Built it so precisely that when the Europeans came over from Vekoma, they said they'd never seen one that well installed. It was precisely put together. It took them a couple of days to bring it up, and just hours almost to get it working, where they usually spend a month or more trying to get it to work. And so it's run 98% or better up, and I understand they had nothing but trouble with the other ones. But we've had pretty good luck with it.
Yeah, I know. Like, I went around to some of the Six Flags parks when they had them, and it seemed like most of the time they were broke down or whatever. And I remember when that was announced that they were bringing one here, there were a lot of people out just kind of in the general theme park community that were saying, oh, Silverwood doesn't know what they're getting themselves into with that thing. And I think it's been, I don't know, for me, it's personally been kind of a yeah, because, you know, you guys have made it run, and you've made it run consistently, and it's kind of like, okay, well, great, you know, you were able to pull it off, so that's awesome.
Well, everything here has been from scratch. We figure out ourselves and have some really good talent, and we don't skimp on it. You know, we try to make sure the maintenance is done well and think ahead, and we've got some good talented guys that make those things keep going.
That's great. So what's the staff here in terms of number? How many people does Silverwood employ?
Well, it varies seasonally quite a bit. We're up to almost 90 that are year-round, which are the ones that hang out through the winter and maintenance and things like that. And then we're up to around 1,000 or so in the summer.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, and it just keeps growing, I'm sure, every year.
It does.
Yeah,
it does.
That's good.
So you mentioned about how you like to... You know, everything here was done. You did it all by yourselves. And I just finished reading your book, which I, by the way, I thought was an amazing read. I love that.
First time I ever wrote anything. I hope you did like it.
I couldn't put it down, so I definitely would recommend it to anybody who likes to read. But one of the things that you mentioned in the book that I'm still having trouble wrapping my mind around is how you mentioned that all of the computer programs here, that you wrote all those yourself. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think that's really an interesting thing.
Well, from very early on, I had trouble finding, and we tried some outside source computer programs, and they usually either don't work good or you don't get the support, or don't get what you want. And since that was my background, I started writing them all myself, and so I still do to today. And we're about the fourth iteration of Rince's point of sale. This year, we just upgraded all touchscreen systems. But what it allows us to do is do innovative features that other parks don't have or spend fortunes trying to get. We have a lot of interesting things we do with our software, and I have one old-timey programmer with me from my old days who helps me with the internet side, because it's just too much to do everything. So he does now. I turned off the internet work over to him, and so between the two of us, we do everything. But anything inside the park, I write, and now he does the outside work on the internet software. But there's thousands of lines of code, and sometimes when we're coming up with a whole new application we're bringing up, it gets a little stressful for a while. But it's nice to be in control of the park.
That's great. I just wanted to jump back to something you said earlier, but you were talking about Boulder Beach, and you were talking about how you wanted to put it in, and you wanted to make it kind of that upscale sort of flavor to it. And I know, like, for me, I've been to lots of water parks all across the country, and that's one thing that stands out to me about Boulder Beach is it's, you know, I mean, the classic example for me is the Avalanche Mountain and the Ricochet Rapids slides over there, how you actually built this mountain that the slides are on, where everybody else out there would have just put, you know, the steel structure and just had the slides out there kind of exposed. But you guys built this mountain, you landscaped it, everything. And what is that? What's your experience? Why go through all that, and what do you think that does?
I think that my problem is I don't like to do anything that everybody else does. And in this industry, it's hard not to, but you always try to put a twist on it. A number of the rides and attractions we've done, I've done that in the water park exactly that. I just said, you know, I don't want to have a whole bunch of steel posts sticking up there, so let's just dig a big hole and end the ride there and put it all, pile up the dirt and start on the top. And the idea eventually is all the trees will grow in and you'll be riding these troughs down through the forests and then wind up in the ponds in the bottom. But the same thing came with Tremors. That coaster was, my original idea was, I thought how neat it would be to have a coaster go underground many times and drop through the side of the gift shop and then come up through the floor inside the shop. And when I presented that back in the early days, we were working with, I'm trying to remember the coaster company at the time. But anyway, the old guy had been building coasters forever, and he said, "Nah, nobody's going to like that. They like the heights." And I said, "No, you know, it's just like flying. You don't know how fast you're going unless you're inches from the ground." So I said, "If you drop in and out of the ground, and this ride makes you think your head's getting chopped off all the time, and most people, you know, love to ride with their hands up. This one here, you always see them pulling her hands back down, you know.
Yeah.
So I drew that up myself in AutoCAD originally with the four undergrounds when I wanted a steep pull out on the first one and go almost as straight up as I could. And I turned over their engineers and said, okay, now you guys make it work. This is what I want. He said, nah, nobody's going to like it. But it's been our most popular coaster ever. And then we go underground four times. And then a couple of years later, somebody back east had to make one go underground five times. I said,
right.
You know, well, obviously, then they got the idea. But that's the whole idea. I don't like to do something that everybody else has done, and it's very difficult. I get bored with just buy a ride and stick it in, even though we did the spin cycle this year, because my other people in the park wanted me to put something in, and that came up. I said, well, put it in. But it doesn't interest me personally because I don't like it. Can't be creative with it. It's just a ride you buy, bolt it to the ground, and run it. So I'm always looking for something that's a little bit out there and hasn't been done before in a park or different quirk on it.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, that definitely, you know, there's not, like to your point, you can go around and everybody's doing it one way. You can put things in quick and you can just throw up the metal frame or whatever and the steel frame and call it good. But to theme it and to landscape it, I mean, I don't know that the average guest maybe recognizes right away what that's doing, but I think sort of subconsciously it's creating that environment where they're actually, you know, it becomes something more than just a ride. It's more of an experience. I don't know.
That's the whole idea, is to kind of just escape, and many times you won't know why you feel the way you do. There's lots of little pieces of that, and mostly the landscaping, the color, trying to match things out. If you look at the new kit areas and the new rides we put down there, and all the incredible landscaping that we wrapped around some of those down there, it was the same thing. In fact, when they were first done, I was away for the winter, and a couple of years ago when we had that one corner with a couple new kiddie rides, cute little rides, I come back and see they're planning on having a big mass of asphalt up to it. I said, no, rip that. No way we're going to do that. So now they've got these wiggly little paths. Some of them go nowhere, just wrap around with landscaping and flowers and all kinds of stuff just to make it feel better when you're in there. And the guests seem to get it because now they come out with their cameras and run around just taking pictures of landscaping.
Right.
So the feel is there. A lot of times people won't know why they feel good about it, but that's the whole idea from sitting there at Disney 1 year ago and saying, why do I feel good when you walk in the park? What piece of this does this? And
right.
Disney's one of their group are one of the best artists out there. So
yep. No, that's true. Now, you guys, I mean, you keep growing here, and you got more and more guests coming through the gate. We're adding more things. It's getting bigger and bigger. How far of a, geographically, are you saying, okay, I want to reach the Northwest, or are you seeing this as something bigger than that, or what? Well, what is your sort of vision for, you know, where's the future of Silverwood go? How big does it get? Who are you trying to bring in here? I know that's a lot of questions.
Well, I haven't attacked it so much from a business marketing point of saying, okay, what geographic area or whatever. We reached the point now where we do draw almost half our business from outside the region. So we fill up all the hotels in the area all summer. It becomes a destination. And to that end, it's allowed me to continue to grow in that direction and add what I think are more quality projects to the park. If we had just not been able to grow outside of the Spokane region, we wouldn't be where we're at today.
Right.
Because you just could not get enough revenues to keep building the way we're doing. Mm-hmm. But by getting outside the region, we are. And so it's let me, my philosophy for a number of years now is to go back into turning this into what I call a boutique park, be the cutest, most amazing little thing you've been to. I mean, because the things we do aren't done for profit. As far as I'm concerned, it's just a personal passion, like a painting. I want to see how neat I can make it. And so we pour the money back into things that people wouldn't even waste their time on. You know, little details all over the park that spend millions of dollars on details that people don't even really know they're there sometimes.
Right.
But that's the whole idea, is that if I can build this, you know, boutique park when I'm done, that people go into and they just go, wow, there's nothing like this anywhere. I can't be as big as Disney, but I can certainly be even more boutique than they are when I get done. And
sure,
that's the plan, with gardens and details and buildings and features and attractions, and that's what I'm trying to do with it.
So just wanted to shift gears a little bit, mm-hmm, and talk about Scarywood,
mm-hmm,
which is personally my favorite part of the park, mm-hmm, every year.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about how you decided to get into that and what happened? It's evolved a lot over the years, I know. It's it's been pretty interesting to see that. But
well, Scarywood, I'd been to other parks and looking for, you know, trying to expand the season a little bit, and I'd seen Knott's Berries a number of times. I get would go down and get behind the scenes with them and seeing what they've done in some of the other parks, and I thought, you know, we can do that. It looks like a lot of fun, but I didn't want to go in just halfway, and so we went right off the bat and poured into the projects like the Blood Bayou. It was a fairly expensive project to put into a place like this. A lot of extensive theming and detailing inside the building. For only 10 to 13 nights, that's a lot of effort to put into one attraction. And I thought we'd just go all out with it. It was difficult to get what I wanted out of it. I wasn't real happy with it the first year because I didn't think it went far enough. I had, again, was not involved during a lot of the detail work. I mean, the original concept's what I wanted, and I was out doing some other things. And when I came back, I was really unhappy with the train ride, as example, the first year. They had put together what I thought was what they thought was scary, but it was more Disney-ish. It was kind of hokey and funny. I said, no, you got to get more horror into this thing. Then I found out you just can't do that with a train, as an example. Nobody's really going to get scared if they're in some kind of enclosed vehicle. You know, you have to be out where you feel like you know, there's nothing to do. You're scared and you're trapped and you're, you know, walking around the dark, groping around. So that particular attraction, for instance, got turned into Zombiewood Express. But my son Nick, who came up with this weird idea that go out and blow up zombies and make it a campy skit rather than just a scary event. And he went probably a little bit beyond what he should have done on that stuff, but I was glad to see him do it. It was really fun. With some of the language and some of the other stuff he did, it's definitely a more of an R-rated ride, and we get comments by some people saying gets a little carried away, but most of the people out there, you watch the guys that are riding, just love it.
Yeah.
So we've had fun with it, and we've been right to the edge with it a few times. Some of the things that are out there, we get written up in newspapers saying it's a little bit too bizarre. But that's if I don't get a little bit of those comments, we didn't go far enough.
Yeah.
So I was trying to get crazy. The only problem I got with it is I can see that we're stuck again geographically. If this was in Seattle, it'd be phenomenally successful. But being where we're at, our problem is that we've only got a limited amount of people available between Spokane and Coeur d'Alene area. And I think we got them all. I mean, we had this big ramp up in attendance 2 years ago, and then last year we kind of went flat. It's like, okay, you hit, everybody wants to come is coming. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, most of them want to come on the two Saturdays, the second and third Saturday of the month for some reason. I can't get them to move to other days. So they wind up, we shut off ticket sales at 4,000, and then they still keep coming, 6,000. Unfortunately, again, you've got attractions that are walk-through. And because you have to limit how many people go through, or you ruin the effect, you got to let a group of six or eight go through, then pause, let another group go through. You don't want them bunching up and everything. You're limited to 3,500 or so a night in the amount of hours you've got. The train can only get about 2,400 a night. So when you get 6,000 people, you're not going to get on everything. It takes more than one night. So I'm having a hard time figuring out how I can have something that would spread it out more. People would move to other nights when it's not so crowded, have more fun doing it that way, and keep the thing going well. It's difficult. It's difficult to make it profitable because the other thing is everybody wants to see something new. But it takes, you know, $200,000 you throw at it every year trying to make things all different again. And there's just not enough revenue. So I'm not sure where it's going. We're trying a little bit different this year of making things that are reusable more, just with a little theming and paneling, and find another way to set it up, because I really want this thing to keep going. But it is a lot of work for us. We spend the entire month of September building it, a lot of labor. Well, they're building it now. I mean, we've got people down there building props and things that work on it all summer long. And then we only get a 10 or 13 day or nights period that we can do it. So it's a difficult business up here, but we're going to keep trying it for a while. Hopefully it'll keep going.
That's great. Yeah, I know. It's become a huge part of Silverwood every year, and I think a lot of parks see that with the Halloween events, that they become as popular, or for some parks even more popular time of year than the regular operating season.
Well, Knott's Berry, I know, does that because that's their most profitable time of the year. But again, you're middle of LA, so you've got millions of people, so they can get 30,000 a night in there, and they just pack them in.
Sure.
But I've been down there when they do that, and they don't have any rules about separating. I mean, just go massing through their little walkthroughs and things like that, and it's not even, the experience isn't quite the same.
Hmm. Interesting. You're
right on the back of the people in front of you, you see the actors resetting, and I like to be more perfectionist about it. I like to see you go through that, like that Blood Bayou or Thunder Canyon, and you really get scared and you don't see how it's done. You don't see any actors moving back and resetting or doing anything, and so it's trying to make it, you know, as perfect as you can makes it difficult, you know, right, to put massive people through it.
So I wanted to just really quickly, you mentioned Nick's involvement in the mm-hmm. in the Scary Wood, and I think Chris and I would both say that Nick Norton's magic show is one of the things that I just don't see a show of that caliber, maybe Disney aside, in any other park I've ever been to. It's just extremely well done. What my question for you is, what is it that you think that brings to the Silverwood experience, and why does he keep doing that year in and year out?
Well, Nick loves to do it. Ever since he was a kid, he enjoys being on the stage and doing something, and he's quite good at doing the magic show. And when he did the train for the Zombiewood Express, you can see the other side of him. He'd be an excellent actor or anything, anywhere. But he just likes doing this. And I love letting him run with some of his projects like that, because his own personality is a little bizarre and way over the top. So he's quite a character in his own right. And it just comes off on stage. But he's always right on the edge. You just never know where he's going to go, and whether it's with the act, what he says, or what he's doing sometimes. But that does make it a nice, edgy show.
It does. It does. You've got a lot of the family is involved in Silverwood.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm curious, you know, the parks out there that are still family run, there's something special about them. I mean, there's only a handful of them out there that haven't been, that are of decent enough size and haven't been gobbled up by the Six Flags or Cedar Fairs or those mm-hmm. companies. And I'm just, what do you think, what kind of challenges and opportunities does being family run present?
Well, the family run park, usually the biggest challenge is if you employ all your family, it's not as easy by far as selecting employees, because if they're not doing really well, it's very difficult to fire them.
Yeah.
So I've had my challenges over the years. Some of my kids are really exceptionally good, and some are not as enthused about it, let's put it that way, and
right.
Haven't fit in as well, and it's difficult to try and be father and be boss at the same time. And but we've settled into roles now that all the kids seem to enjoy the role they're in. Some of them have gotten to a certain point and that's it, and others have moved on. Like my number three son now is general manager, and he does phenomenally well at running the park.
Mm-hmm.
Great personality. He really gets into it and feels it, and he's moving ahead out in the industry with being on committees at the IAPA and tourism committees in the state. So he's into the business. I know this is in his heart forever. I mean, he wants to do the same thing. So I expect, I spend a lot of time with him making sure he's got the same attention to detail and understands what makes the park what it is, and fight constantly the other employees, which you'll get, that try to cost cut. You know, you'll get somebody in food and beverage and they think they can make me happy by cutting the cost of the chicken or cutting the cost of this, and I just get furious. I said, all I want is the best quality, not the best price. In fact, I tell them, what about cost of goods or profit? I don't care. I would rather serve you the best burger you ever got, the best chicken, the best this, whatever, and make it up by the individual's experience is so great they'll tell other people. And I have fought it for years. It's so hard to get people to come in and work for you, because they've always been ingrained that your whole idea is to get cost to to profit the bottom line, not quality. And it's amazingly how difficult it is to beat on them, and you'll go back and find them and do it again. You know, I'll go in and I'll say, this doesn't taste as... The other day I went out and tasted one of our cinnamon buns. I went and I actually had a French chef, young fellow, that I brought on years ago in boating when I was doing. I brought him in to go through my products, and one of them was the pastries at the front gate. And he did these phenomenal cinnamon rolls. I made him work on them until he could beat Cinnabon. I said, and he kept making them. I said, no, that's not it. That's not it. And I said, go get some Cinnabons. I said, now you know what I'm talking about. So we finally beat them. Then I was out a week or so ago, and I went and tasted one. I said, these things taste a little flat. He said, yeah, the warehouse, they cut me back. Instead of using real vanilla, we used synthetic vanilla because it was like you know, $10 a bottle instead of $40 a bottle. I said, you go shoot somebody in the head. You go back and get the real stuff. And you forget it. You know, it's got to be the best it can be.
Yeah.
But that happens all the time. And it's so hard. But I go out all the time and I put my nose in the products, taste test them, check them. Everything from, you know, flowers, dirt in a somewhere in a ride it's not supposed to be there, a broken belt upsets me, you know, if it's not perfect. And I'm still hammering on them to make it better. And there's always room for improvement. Yeah. But again, back to the kids again, Paul gets that. He follows around with me, he sees it, so he stays on top of it for me now.
That's great. Yeah, and I think, I mean, gosh, you know, to your point, it's just so important, that kind of quality. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, you know, I just think of like Walt Disney and the things you read about how he was when he was doing Disneyland and the level of detail and quality he wanted there and how people told him he was crazy or wasn't worth doing this or that. He was just absolutely convinced that if you made the experience right for the people, things were going to work out, you know, and it wasn't just about trying to chase every penny. And so that's really neat to hear you say that, because I think that's unfortunately, I think that's kind of the exception rather than the rule in the industry.
So. Well, it is in any business, because they get into their paperwork and they'll look at their profit and loss in the year, look at their reports. And most of your theme parks that are bought up are run by some corporate office somewhere and some accountant that says, oh, I see your budget's off. You get a little more profit and loss. And that's what they give incentives on. And here I don't. I give incentives on quality. I'll go and tell them, I said, I don't care if your costs and our profits go down in a certain area if the quality goes up. But if you're not giving me the best quality you can get, you're not doing what I'm asking for. Because to me, I don't really care about the money anymore. I got plenty. The park does well. I've done everything I really want to do outside, so I'm not looking for more money. I'm looking to see how much more details I can put into painting. I look at it as a painting. And it's my personal paint, and I'm trying to see how great I can make it. And you can't do it by, you know, trying to pinch pennies. You've just got to constantly look for ways to improve the product. And it's fun. I mean, but I go out here numerous times in the morning. I go do a little run, exercise run, and then walk the whole park, one end to the other. When my wife goes out, we'll take pictures of something that's a little off or something not detailed, it's not right. And when, you know, see some stains on something that shouldn't be there. And or just a design element we don't like, and put it down. Okay, we're going to redo this, and it's fun to see how you can improve it.
That's great. It definitely shows. I mean, I think certainly would say that Silverwood is ahead of the majority of the pack in their attention to detail and the things that they're focused on. So that's great. Well, we don't want to take up too much more of your time, but. I guess before we wrap it up, anything you want to tell us about the future of the park or kind of where you're thinking things are headed?
Well, all I can do is say that there is a major, major development we're going to be going into by 2015 opening, but can't really talk about it because this is so bizarre. Nobody in their right mind, again, would do what we're going to do. And I don't know anybody who's really tried to do it this way, so... It's another one of those bizarre things that I finally have found something that I've been trying for probably 6, 7, 8 years. I've been studying, trying to figure out how to do up here. So anyway, it'll probably add another third again or half again to the park size. So it'll be another whole section, but it's definitely off the charts. People are going to go, are you kidding me? They're going to do that?
Well, so, that's great.
So anyway, you'll hear about it. It'll be coming out, but until we have... the thing more detailed, more specific. It'll definitely come out that time. Glad to let you know about it when we get to that point. We'll talk about it. But.
We will be anxiously looking forward to it. There's been a lot of great surprises over the years, and I know that a lot of our listeners and followers of our website and the things we do have been really positive about all the changes. So looking forward to the future. It sounds like it's going to be great.
It'll be interesting, that's for sure.
All right. Well, once again, Gary Norton, the owner of Silverwood Theme Park, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
And so there you have it, folks. There's our interview with Gary Norton. And Chris, I got to say, I mean, listening back on that, it still just amazes me, this guy and his vision and the kind of person he is. I can't help but feel like I'm – I'm listening to someone who just has sort of a Disney-esque vibe that comes out in his personality and what he's done with the Silverwood.
Absolutely. And he even states it a couple times in his book about how he was so impressed with Disney when he was a child. And I mean, we all kind of are when we go there as a kid, but you know, he was around when it opened and went there some of the earlier years of the park and saw it in the days when Walt was in charge, and really just saw it grow from the ground up. And so, and it shows in the park that he's got now. He's definitely taken a lot of what he saw there and just soaked it up and then tried to replicate it as best he can, and successfully, I think.
Yeah.
One of the cool things that he mentions in his book is that he's one of the last, if not the last, living person right now who started a theme park and still runs it. It's the only family-owned theme park where the owner still is in charge and is still living today. He's the real deal.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's not much of that out there. I don't know. There may be some exceptions that we're not aware of, but it's definitely rare. And you know, he's still got his hands in it. He still walks the park. Silverwood doesn't have the money that Disney has or that Universal has. So if you're waiting for Silverwood to open Pirates of the Caribbean, don't hold your breath. But they're with the funds that they have, it's amazing the things they do. And I'm always impressed every year when we go back. They've carved a new section of the park out with just brand new landscaping and trails to walk through and scenery. And I mean, they don't need to do that. You know, it's got nothing to do with the new ride. They just do it. And it's those kind of things that make a real impression on me, because I say, well, why is he doing this? Well, he's doing it for the overall experience for the guest, even if they don't really recognize it at the time.
Yeah, it's just those are the things that you just subconsciously, you sort of walking through a theme park and you just kind of have that feeling of that. And it's all those little elements that add up to that.
Yeah, it is. And Silverwood does it as well as most of the rest of them out there. I mean, I would say that on their level with their budget, they're doing the same kind of things that Disney or Universal are doing. And I'm really impressed. Look, if you're listening out there and you haven't been to Silverwood, I got to say, get up there, check it out. It is worth the trip. You got the beautiful Northwest scenery, mountains covered with pine trees all around you. And it literally is out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I've had people that have told me, you know, oh, go to Holiday World, it's out in the middle of nowhere, or go see this park or that park, they're out in the middle of nowhere. And I go to these parks and yeah, they're in rural areas or smaller towns, but they're not in the middle of nowhere like Silverwood is in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
you're driving down a highway in the mountains and then all of a sudden, and there's nothing around you. And then all of a sudden the trees break and there's a bunch of roller coasters and rides.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there's some great rides at Silverwood. I mean, you've got the original Corkscrew from Knott's Berry Farm that still runs great and is just a classic piece of coaster history. It's the first roller coaster of the modern era to turn people upside down. And it's still there. It's still running great. I can remember riding that thing at Knott's Berry Farm years and years ago. I'm showing my age here.
Yeah, I was going to say that just shows how old you are.
But I love getting on that Corkscrew because it reminds me of when I was a little kid riding it at Knott's. You've got a great log flume, a great raft ride. You've got the train, which I dare say maybe Dollywood's train aside, I have not been on a better train anywhere at any theme park. You've got two great wooden coasters.
Absolutely.
Tremors has been given some TLC these past few years, and it's one of those coasters from start to finish. There's no Silverwood has no mid-course breaks on its coasters, so you come down that first drop into the tunnel on Tremors, and it is full speed the whole way, and it is one of the best wooden coasters that I've ever been on in my life, and every year I just am reminded of that. And then Timber Terror, you know, what can I say about Timber Terror? I have a soft spot for Timber Terror. I loved it when it first came out. It was a great out-and-back Woody. It's not aged very well.
Yeah, it's getting the Ghostwriter treatment.
Yeah, you know, I wish they would give it some love here, and I believe they will. It's probably just a matter of time.
You gotta try it backwards though.
Yeah, yeah.
If they do that in October, they turn the train around backwards, and that's still pretty awesome.
Yeah, they do that for the haunt, and I've got to try that. I haven't done that yet.
Yeah.
And then you know, look, you've got a Vekoma giant inverted boomerang, which I'm just gonna say it. Hey, look, Silverwood made it work. They've got it running. It's reliable. I'm not gonna sit here and tell you it's the smoothest coaster in the world, but you go to that park and that coaster's running. And
a lot of that has to do with the good people over at Rocky Mountain Coasters. Oh, yeah. They were the ones that put that thing together when it arrived, and
yep.
we all know their reputation,
exactly.
Their quality,
exactly. And so that's a big part of it. But I mean, I just remember all the theme park internet boards when it was announced that Silverwood was getting deja vu from Six Flags Great America, and I thought, oh boy, I remember thinking to myself, bad choice. But I'm so glad they proved me wrong. I mean, it's a good ride. It's
totally
a good coaster. So yeah, they got all that. They've got one of the best water parks that I've ever been to. You know, and as far as theming is concerned, I think it's got to be a top 10 water park in the country.
Yeah, I've never seen a water park that has that kind of landscaping and theming. And I mean, it's over the years, it's just grown so much. I mean, I was looking at some older pictures of it compared to now. And I mean, that Lazy River looks like you're going through a forest now with how much growth those bushes and trees have had. It's just crazy.
It is. It looks so good, and they've done such a great job. So look, get on up to Silverwood if you haven't done it already. It is, like I say, it's worth it. You can't go wrong. And it just gets better and better every year. And, you know, it's because of Gary and his staff and the great job that they do. And, you know, we'll definitely, keep our relationship very close with them so we can have opportunities to talk with them in the future and maybe share some more with you guys. And that's, I guess maybe one other thing that I would shout out to anyone who's listening to this podcast is, if you would like to hear more of this, if you liked what we did here today, let us know. Shoot us an email. Go to our message boards at www.rollercoasteralley.com and give us your thoughts. You know, we've had a great time doing this. I don't know.
Yeah, this has been fun.
So
always good to talk.
And it can only go one direction from here. I mean,
I don't think it's true.
We can get any worse at this. So, but you know, we'd like to maybe think about doing some more of these with Silverwood and maybe some other coaster contacts and parks around the Northwest. Yes, there is more than one.
There definitely is.
Contrary to popular belief. And, you know, who knows what the future will unhold. But if you like it, again, www.rollercoasteralley.com and, you know, let us know or send us an email to mail@rollercoasteralley.com. And Chris, why don't you tell everybody about Gary's book and how they can get their hands on that?
Okay, yeah. So like I mentioned before, Gary wrote a book about his history and how he built Silverwood. The book's called American Theme Park. You can get it on Silverwood's website at www.silverwoodthemepark.com. I believe it's also available on Amazon.com. Great read. The guy just tells his whole story from start to finish about all the things that happened along the way. It's an awesome, awesome read, especially for us that are really into this kind of stuff. It's amazing to hear about his journey and all the things that led up to the park. A lot of it he talked about in the interview you heard, but there's so much more to that story that really I was blown away by it. There were things in that book that I would never have ever even thought about or when. He really goes into a lot of cool details and interesting things about that. So definitely would recommend getting your hands on that and reading it. I think you'll find it very interesting and And yeah, it's a great read.
Yeah,
can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And if you liked what you heard in the little 30 minutes that we spoke with him, you know, the book is just, like Chris said, it's just taking that type of thing and expounding on it. So definitely check out the book. And again, check out our website. What's the address, Chris?
www.rollercoasteralley.com.
Ah, said like a professional. You're sounding like you could make a career out of this, Chris. I think your voice has matured as the podcast has gone on, and you've sort of adopted a little bit of a radio persona. Maybe I should just shut up and let you do the talk this time.
That's okay.
We appreciate
you're doing fine. You're the big brother. You're in charge.
Oh, great. I only if it's well received. If it sucked, it's all Chris's fault. So.
Oh, come on. All right.
Yeah. So everybody, check out the website, and again, shoot us some feedback. Let us know what you thought of our podcast and the interview, and maybe we'll have a little bit more of this in the future. But in the meantime, this is Mike and Chris from rollercoasteralley.com signing off, and have a great one, and maybe you'll hear from us again soon in the future. Take care, everybody.
Bye.